Hello, I'm Richard Adey. This is Best Practice, RN's new program on management and work. Today, we're all about hiring or recruitment. So getting new people into your business, getting the right person into a role is vital. All enterprises depend on their people. For most, they are their biggest asset and largest cost. But the standard way of selecting a new recruit is by interview, and the majority of us aren't very good at conducting them. So, sometimes we get it right, sometimes we reject brilliant performers, and sometimes we hire someone who's lazy or destructive or a complete disaster. And this costs hundreds of millions of dollars a year, so it's very much worth trying to do better. Ben Dattner is an executive coach in New York.
It's incredibly important because the cost of a bad hire is conservatively estimated at 1 year's total compensation. By the time you recruit the person, onboard the person, orient the person, and wait for the person to come up to speed about the knowledge they need to perform effectively, if you need to replace that person, it's going to take a full year's compensation as a cost.
So obviously that's vital. How good are we at actually doing this?
Not very. Turnover keeps going up. Tenure in organizations keeps going down. And most people are pretty bad interviewers. We all overestimate how good we are at judging character and competence, but the average validity of an unstructured interview is around 20%, which means you're only going to get incremental validity or incremental predictive power above your baseline 20% of the time.
That's one in five. That's not good.
That's right.
So it's going wrong at the interview, which, as you've just explained, we think, especially if you've done a few of them, we think we're all pretty good at. How is it specifically going wrong?
Well, people make up their minds very quickly. They rush to judgment. There's some research that shows that after about 2 seconds, people make up their mind about a candidate's suitability, and then they spend the rest of the interview, however long it may be, simply trying to confirm those initial impressions.
Right. So we all have biases. We all make instant decisions, and those things then become self-perpetuating. But hang on, if I don't know, and there's different ways that the result can go. But say if we're on an interview panel and we make what transpires a year, 18 months later, to be an obviously bad hire, why can't we just think, well, hang on, we got that wrong. Let's not do it like that the next time.
Because we have selective memory. And because we all want to think of ourselves as good judges of character, it's intimidating and anxiety-provoking to think that we can be wrong in our judgments of other people, personally and professionally. So we like to think, I knew all along that this person wasn't going to be successful, or I knew all along that this person was going to be a superstar. But if you check back onto your notes, if you take notes, and if you use an interview scorecard like the one mentioned in my HBR blog, you're likely to find out over time that you might not be as good as you think you are.
Well, let's talk about that, because what you're talking about is a model of detection theory, which brings some rigor to it. I think we're both agreed that rigor is needed here with a 20% success rate. So there's essentially four outcomes, aren't there, from the interview process?
Yes, and this comes from the defense world, which is you can have a signal on your radar screen. You can have a signal or not a signal, so a little blip on your screen or no blip on the screen. And in fact, there can be incoming Soviet ICBMs or it can be SEALs playing near the cables in that case, it would be Russian submarines or SEALs playing, cavorting in the water. And you can either think that there's an incoming threat of some sort or not detect a threat, and there can either be a threat or not be a threat. So if you think there's a missile coming towards us and there is, that's a hit, and hopefully you can take some countermeasures so the missile itself doesn't hit. If there's a missile coming towards you and you don't detect it, that would be a miss. And if there is no missile and you don't think there's a missile, that's a correct rejection. And if you think there's a missile and there isn't, that's a false positive. Accuracy is important in that, and it's important in hiring as well.
How does that translate to the world of hiring, the missiles and the not missiles?
Right. Well, you can think this person is a great candidate. So on your radar, they register as a superstar, and they can either become or be a superstar or not. Or you can think this person is certainly someone not to hire, and it can either be a good decision or a bad decision to not hire them. So there's type one error or type two error. Type one error is hiring the wrong candidate. Type two error is not hiring the right candidate.
Okay. And there are examples of that, aren't there? So, you know, as somebody who you reject and they go somewhere else and they're brilliant.
Well, my favorite example of that is Jan Koum, who did not get a job at Facebook, ended up founding WhatsApp, which he then sold to Facebook for $19 billion.
Yeah, that's an expensive miss, Facebook.
Absolutely.
So the other outcomes are a good candidate is hired, and the other one that you want to achieve is a bad candidate who's not hired. But I suppose the real issue is the bad candidate who's hired.
Exactly right, because that's the one that you're really going to pay the price for. If you don't hire someone who goes on to be super successful somewhere else, it's extremely unlikely that you'll hear about it. If you're the guy who didn't sign the Beatles for a recording contract, you hear about it, but that's pretty rare.
So would it be fair to say then that that's what most interview panels are most concerned about and most anxious not to get wrong?
Yes. So in other words, they are so concerned about hiring the wrong candidate that in many cases they may not hire the right candidate, and they might also use the wrong criteria and benchmark to ascertain who the good and not good candidates are.
Okay, so the first thing goes back to something you said before, Ben. We should be keeping notes when we do interviews, shouldn't we? We shouldn't just be making them and then throwing them away. We should be keeping them.
Absolutely, and the more quantitative it can be and the more you can validate it against their subsequent performance, the more likely it is that you'll learn over time, okay, you know, I'm pretty tough on this kind of candidate, or I'm too lenient on that kind of candidate, or I'm an excellent judge of technical ability, but I really don't know whether somebody's going to be a good manager, or vice versa. And when you learn those things, first of all, you can try to overcome your biases to say just because someone went to this school or comes from this kind of other company doesn't necessarily mean they're going to perform or behave in the way I predict they will. So that's one thing. And the other thing is if you realize, hey, I'm a really bad judge of whether someone will be a charismatic presenter, and you have a colleague who is a good judge of whether someone will be a charismatic presenter, you can delegate or offload assessing that particular criteria to your colleague rather than doing it yourself.
So quantitative, what we should be doing and what's best to do is come up with numbers against specific criteria.
That's right.
Do people
and
actually...
So the ones that I suggested in the interview scorecard, which your listeners can find on hbr.org if they're interested, is this person going to be a good organizational citizen? How are their interpersonal skills? How are their technical skills? How are their managerial skills? And if you can come up with a set of standard questions to assess those criteria, then you can then validate them against subsequent performance.
And should we be trying to generate a number for each of those? So a number out of 10 or a number out of 100 or something like that?
Yep, I think it's helpful to do that.
All right. It's not enough, though, is it, to do it, though it sounds way more organized than many interviews that I've seen in the past. You've actually got to keep them. And there should be, I guess, some kind of process to review them.
That's right. So perhaps on a yearly basis or a semi-annual basis, whenever you do a performance review, you can then go into your file and say, let me validate what I thought this person was going to do or be against what they turned out to do or be.
The thing that occurs to me, Ben, as you're talking about this, is that I'm thinking, we're all too human. I don't know if people are prepared to have the discipline of that if what it shows is that they're bad at this. Do you know what I mean? They don't want to get
absolutely
the blame
right
for hiring the wrong person.
No question about it. So we don't want to learn how good we are, even though the only way to get better is to learn how good we are and then to improve it over time. We also don't want to hand into our HR department, okay, here's my scorecard of this kind of candidates, and they say, hey, you're discriminating against this kind of candidate or that kind of candidate. I mean, we'd prefer to keep that on the down low, as we say.
So does that mean that our own self-interest and our own concern about looking bad because of making poor decisions is actually holding back hiring better people across the whole enterprise?
Absolutely. And I think there's a pretty good analogy to investing, which is we all think, okay, now's the time to buy, now's the time to sell. And we all think, okay, I'm going to make decisions about how to manage my investments rather than either delegating it to a professional money manager or just having a passive low-fee strategy, which over time turns out to be the best thing to do. We all think, no, now I know this time it's really going to get bad and I have to sell, or this is really going to be a hot industry or company and I have to buy. And anybody who benchmarks their own investment performance against an index is extremely likely to find out that he or she underperforms the index. But how many of us actually do that? Or if we do that and see that we're underperforming, as 90% of individual investors do, we still think, well, next time I'm going to get it right.
Yes. Okay. Is anyone doing this with the rigor that you discuss in the HBR piece?
Well, companies like Google do have very well-developed people analytics departments that look at all kinds of statistics, all kinds of numbers, and all kinds of data. And if you look at Laszlo Bock's book, Work Rules, you'll see that he talks about taking a disciplined approach to interviews, what do interviews predict, what is the incremental validity of doing different numbers of interviews, and who are the good interviewers and who are not. And so Google looks at things where they can help interviewers overcome their own biases, learn what kind of biases they have, and get better at their analytic predictions over time. And there's a great website that your listeners might be interested in, which is called Rework, which is a Google website where you can search for things like interview guides, how to overcome bias, and things like that.
Well, we will link to it from our website. Ben, are there other approaches or strategies that companies that are hiring people can use to supplement this to get better outcomes?
Well, one of the things I help my clients do as an organizational psychologist is to use batteries of psychometric tests. And what research has conclusively found is that when you use interviews in combination with psychometric tests that look at cognitive ability, cognitive style, and personality, that combined with interviewer judgments is likely to get a much, much better predictive hit rate than either psychometric tests or interviews alone.
So adding more information and from different approaches pays off.
If you ask any psychologist, he or she will say multiple measures is the way to increase predictive power.
Been fascinating. Real insight today. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ben Dattner. It's worth reading his piece in the Harvard Business Review. And if you go to our homepage, we've put links to both the resources Ben mentioned, Rework and Work Rules. abc.net.au/rn is where you'll find us. This is Best Practice on RN, online and via podcast. I'm Richard Adie. Well, now it's time for Jargon Decoder. This is the part of Best Practice in which we look at language, management language. Most of it, I don't have to tell you, is not elegant or even clear. But by one definition, it's very successful because it's thriving. I'm joined by Amanda Woodard, who edits HRM magazine. Amanda, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
If I said to you that management jargon was the weed of the English language, would that be fair?
Oh, I think it would be more than fair. I mean, the English language is a deep and beautiful resource, and yet in a business setting, it's become mechanized. In fact, in the US, they've coined a wonderful term. They call it jargon monoxide, which I like very much. And it's this terribly convoluted use of English with absurd terms that, in the end, actually mean very, very little. And they are having a very bad effect upon business. Yes. They're alienating a lot of people.
This is the language of Milton and Keats and Shakespeare and Dickens. And yet, well, we're going to explore some examples shortly. But the reason I put it to you that it was the weed was it seems to me it's adaptable, resilient, it's proliferating, it's popping up everywhere.
It is. And I find that, you know, I'm even using it myself. It's become so ubiquitous that terms like, you know, the DNA of a company, well, you know, it's leaking out from a business setting and it's becoming pervasive. I particularly find offensive the words that, you know, we have to be passionate about our jobs. Well, passion for me resides in the bedroom and in the home, and that's where it should stay. Same too with commitment, you know, commitment to our jobs. So it's perhaps indicative of how work wants to infiltrate into our personal lives even more than it already does. And that is being seen, I think, more in the language that we're using.
Let's start with job ads, because it seems to me they're chock-a-block with them, and sometimes you're not clear. Well, I'm not clear. You work in the space, so you're going to do better than me on what they mean. So this job that we've both got a copy of is a job ad for a senior account manager. I won't say the company.
Yeah.
Now, I'm just going to read bits to you, Amanda, and I'm going to ask you to explain what they mean.
I'll try.
Okay. So this it says, with the company's focus on evolution. Now, they're not a biological company, Amanda.
No, well, simple language is no longer kind of acceptable in job ads because it's perhaps perceived as not interesting enough. So we can't have a company's focus on change or how it manages its future. It has to be Darwinian. You know, change isn't sufficient. Evolution is world-changing, which undoubtedly this product or service isn't world-changing. But nevertheless, this is the inference that comes out of this use of the word evolution. It's completely ludicrous.
Yes, focused on evolution to meet market needs. We have a differentiating?
Yeah, what's wrong with different? Again, it's this attempt to sound perhaps more clever than, you know, you actually are. So let's use strange words like differentiating or leverage or synergy, because it gives this impression that we are really smart and the person who's reading it isn't as smart. But again, that has a hugely alienating effect. So differentiating, nonsense. Yeah, Let's just use different.
It seems to me it gets worse here because we have a differentiating product roadmap. I get the differentiating is different, but product roadmap, I'm now completely lost.
Yeah, no, well, I'm with you. In fact, I think we've gone veered right off the road with this one and we're kind of lying in a ditch somewhere with our product roadmap, wondering what the hell we do to get out of here. I wish I could tell you what a differentiating product roadmap means, because it's clearly nonsensical. And I wonder seriously whether the people who wrote this ad even understand it. I think quite often they don't. I mean, a roadmap, if I had to guess, it means a plan for the future, a strategy, something as simple as that.
Yes. All right, I'm going to read the next sentence in full and then we'll come back and I'll get you to pull it apart for me. So the dynamic role of this senior account manager is to bring this to life for our media agency and government clients. All right, so let's go back. Dynamic. What does that mean?
Yes, dynamic is kind of ubiquitous now in business jargon. For me, it always inspires this vision of someone exploding from a cake. But there isn't a single company that exists, I think, that doesn't have dynamic written somewhere in their business plan or certainly in job ads, it's everywhere. I suppose the idea is that they don't want to give the impression that people are going to sit around not working hard enough. I think it's part of all this productivity-driven language
right.
that we're using, that, you know, there's no time for tea breaks. We've got to kind of keep on keeping on and work at the absolute top level.
So as soon as you see the word dynamic in a job ad, it's supposed to kind of go, whoosh, keep going.
Keep going, that's right.
That's it.
Yeah.
Right.
Keep
right.
moving.
So the next bit was to bring this to life for our media agency and government clients.
Well, this is comical, isn't it? Was it dead before? what was the status of it before it needed bringing to life? It's I think anyone who's listening and who's thinking of writing job ads needs to read it back to themselves and needs to put themselves in the shoes of the person reading it and think, well, what is the opposite here of what I'm saying? And how is that going to affect people reading it and consuming it and wanting to use this? What is the knowledge they're trying to get out of this?
All right. Okay. Next sentence, he says bravely, based on your understanding of government policy and organisational structure, you'll develop collaborative relationships to provide tailored product solutions and consulting services to drive revenue generation. Now, collaborative, that's a word that comes up a lot. It's like dynamic, isn't it?
It is. It's sort of obvious. If you're working in a team or you're working in any organisation, then by its very nature, you're working in a collaborative way. Everything we do when we are part of a society, whether it's our family or whether it's our work colleagues, is collaborative to some extent. So it's just that word that's thrown in there all the time to fill space and you know, it's obvious that we're not talking about loving relationships here or intimate relationships. It's an unnecessary word. And then tailored product solutions.
Tailored we see a lot, don't we?
Yeah, tailored or bespoke, words drawn out of the cloth manufacturing industry,
clothing industry.
That's right. To give the illusion or impression that these are very niche, very highly refined working practices. I think it's, you know, it is shorthand that is being used here.
It's sort of saying you can't do the same thing over and over again.
Yes.
When actually, a lot of the time, that's what you will be doing.
Of course. A lot of tasks are repetitive, but we dare not mention that in an ad.
Okay, let's press on. Ability to juggle a wide range of responsibilities in a fast-paced environment, complementing your hands-on approach.
That's right. Well, fast-paced, of course, we've become a nation of sprinters. Wouldn't you love just for once just to see an ad that said, a wide range of responsibilities in a slow and leisurely pace with great thought.
No one's ever going to say that. We're not just sprinters, though, are we? We're jugglers.
That's right. We're also circus performers. We're juggling as we sprint. We are multitasking, and it's comical. It's completely comical.
And what about the hands-on bit towards the end of the sentence? Because surely you can't be hands-off if you're doing a job.
No. You can't. You could toes on, perhaps, or elbows on, or elbows on desk, or maybe hands raised on to the head in despair, perhaps, once you've got through all this business jargon. Is there any other kind of approach than hands-on? No, of course there isn't. I also wonder sometimes when you see ads filled with words like this, it's whether the person creating the ads actually knows what this job is all about. And I suspect in many cases, they're not sure. You also got to bear in mind that you've got people competing, writing these job ads. So there's also obscurity perhaps comes around because of a lack of insight in the company about what they want this job to be.
Actually, that sentence, which I thought had finished, turns out not to have been finished at all. Because complementing your hands-on approach, creative flair and ability to influence and engage across a diverse range of stakeholders. Mm. We'll go to town, Amanda, because I'm now pretty tired. I need to sit down, I think.
Yes, I know. It's creative, engaging. These are uber kind of buzzwords. And the whole impression is to create this feeling of excitement around the job that they're advertising. But, you know, when you get to the end of it, you want to go away and do something really exciting, like rearrange your sock drawer or something like that, because it's exhausting.
Yeah.
And you think, well, how can one person embody all these...
It's the unicorn
frantic
thing, isn't it? Yes.
And necessary, vaguely termed skills. I think it's quite intimidating, actually, if you read this as a job applicant.
Amanda, why does this happen? You've already mentioned that there might be competition in terms of writing the ad, but they're not helpful in a way. These things are not communicating clearly what they're supposed to communicate.
No, they're not. There's some theories around the impact of the GFC on all this and the kind of clandestine way that language was used around that when all kinds of dodgy things were going on and companies were collapsing. And some people argue that the language has suffered as a result since then, and it's become more obscure. It's become clarity has been a victim of that. And I think that's an interesting argument. But where I work in the human resources sector, there's also perhaps a problem that, you know, in some organisations, human resources do have a seat at the table, but in other organisations, they don't. And so there is always trying to prove their value to the organisation. And I think in some instances, what that leads to is kind of pompous use of the language, a kind of overblown, inflated use of the language, which has the opposite effect of what it's meant to, which is meant to attract some of the best people you can to your company and then keep them really motivated. I read a statistic the other day that said nearly 60% of people will not apply for a job if they've read the advert and they feel that it's full of jargon. It immediately puts them off. That's got to affect the bottom line. You know, if companies are missing out on a large number of applicants who won't apply because of jargon, then surely that's the rally cry to sort of look at how they're using language.
Perhaps there's a niche for a firm that will actually write the ad in easy-to-understand language.
I'm waiting for that phone.
Amanda, it has been fascinating. It's been bewildering at times, but thanks for walking me through all that.
Pleasure.
Amanda Woodard is the editor of HRM Online. You'll find details on our webpage at abc.net.au/rn. And if you've got something to say about recruitment interviews or job ads or jargon, do get in touch. You can email us from the homepage. Best Practice is produced by Murata Dias. Our sound engineers, Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. I'm Richard Addy.